So we've talked a lot about suffering, etc., suffering and trauma and whatnot this past bit. The great hindrances of doubt and wrestle, that's all that. So I want to swing toward the yummy for a little bit here in high summer and speak about practice and speak about this set of qualities that are called the Brahma-viharas, the Brahma or divine or godly. And vihara literally means dwelling place. It's like a hermitage. So the divine or heavenly abodes. And we'll look at them one each week, and let it spread out into other topics. But the basic structure is that there are four qualities that are considered to be heart qualities in the early Buddhist system. The first is kindness itself, like the basic heart quality of kindness. The word metta or maitri in Sanskrit literally means friendliness. And from this basic quality of the heart, the rest of the divine abodes unfold. When this basic kindness meets suffering in the world, in others or ourselves, it naturally becomes compassion. So kindness turns to compassion. It's not even really a different quality, but it's a different, filter. Insert Instagram joke here. It's a different filter on the quality. Kindness turns to compassion when it meets suffering. When kindness meets well-being, especially like really delightful well-being, success, pleasure, happiness, it turns into a particular kind of joy. And that's the joy that has the flavor of like appreciation. You know, when I see you happy, I just get happy. And so it's a joy that's also laced with generosity. It's specifically about the joy that comes when seeing the happiness of others. And the fourth quality is a mysterious quality called equanimity. It's a heart quality. It's a quality based in kindness. And almost it's based in having broadened the range of what our kindness can contact, to contact deep suffering and to contact powerful joy and happiness. And having broadened that range, this fourth quality is a quality of the heart at rest or at peace. Equanimity is the heart unruffled or balanced no matter what it encounters. Equanimity is the balance quality in the system, so that kindness doesn't become clingy, compassion doesn't become pity or despair, sympathetic joy doesn't become kind of manic celebration, but it holds the middle ground. So we'll talk about each of these a little bit in turn. And in a way, what we're pointing to is that in practice, even though we so often, or I so often at least, emphasize the aspects of practice that are subtractive, that are stripping away, that are letting go of grasping, letting go of hatred, letting go of delusion, renunciation, letting go of more and more things that bind us and create the states of distress, of anxiety and fear, that this dropping away actually doesn't just kind of take qualities out of the system and leave a sort of empty neutrality. It takes qualities out of the system, and what it leaves is actually a kind of beautiful warmth. And this is mysterious, I think. Like, I don't know why it has to be this way. What if it just was that, you know, we let go further and further and we become just like empty of feeling, empty of response until we kind of just dissolve? And sometimes the picture of practice looks like that or sounds like that. You know, so much talk about emptiness. And it sounds like we kind of just become, you know, holograms and then memories or something. But it's not what seems to happen. What actually seems to happen is that the less we cling and fear and worry and obsess, the more we not only just rest in being in contact with things as they are, but we rest in a kind of sweetness. It's almost like if I'm not miserable, it turns out that I'm actually kind of happy. I'm not just nothing. So this first quality, metta, is the Pali word, friendly. The standard translation is loving kindness. I'll propose that it's different from what we might use the word love for. And the word pema is, or prema, is translated as love. Pema in Pali, prema in Sanskrit. It's translated as love. And it has a different flavor, right? There's the specific adoration or delighting in something that we call loving it. I like the word love for metta, as long as we understand that we're talking about its kind of universal quality, its vast quality. The practice of metta, mythically, was said to have been taught by the Buddha to a group of monks in a very specific circumstance. It says a bunch of monks, they wanted to do really hard, gutsy practice, so they went to this grove in the wilderness, in the trees, that was known to be haunted. And you want to know that this is within a system that understands that the particularly big or old or important trees have spirits that live in them, that are associated with that tree. And substantial, elements in nature have spirits. There's a spirit for the spring, for a big rock outcropping, for a mountain, of course, for a river, of course, for big trees. So this is some of the sentient ecosystem that the Buddha took for granted. There's many scriptures where it says, you know, a tree spirit appears in the assembly of monastics to ask a question. In the texts, the devas, and particularly like the nature spirits, they're kind of they're painted as if they're kind of shy and a little ignorant. They're always a little bit like, oh, I don't want to bother, you know. Mike, I just have this little tiny question. It's just nice to be here, you know. Haha, don't mind me. But then the text actually describes them, and it says, you know, a certain deva of unsurpassed beauty lighting up the grove as if it were midday appears. Like, these beings are radiant. They show up and they're a little bit like, hi, haha, you know. Like, you know, I don't know. Like the new Spider-Man, who's like really awkward teenager. Never mind. Not like that. No, they are kind of awkward teenager-y painted sometimes in the texts. So this grove is known to be haunted. The tree spirits, they don't like people being there. And so the monks go to meditate there, and they're doing their practice. And they start to get afraid, right? They hear creaking and noises. They see the little eyes or whatever they see, they get scared at night. And they go running back to the Buddha and they're like, Blessed One, we tried to practice there, we're afraid. And the Buddha says, oh, do this practice. And he sends them back to the grove. They go back to the grove and they do this practice of metta. And the way that the earliest texts describe the metta practice is that the practitioner radiates the quality of loving kindness or friendliness in all of the directions, radiates it to the front, to the side, to the back, to the other side, above and below. And it's really this directional thing, like you Like you have this like searchlight that just like shines out a warmth in a given direction. And the practitioner shines this out to each of the four quarters. Embedded in this wish, in this friendliness, is the wish of well-being, right? It's like, whoever this wish comes into contact with, may they be free from harm, free from suffering. So the monks go back to this grove, they do this practice. The tree spirits initially are like, oh, they're back, rah, rah, rah. But it turns out that devas, that's the word in Pali and Sanskrit for divine beings, but we would almost want to say like spirits or angels is kind of a nice translation for it. They really like metta. They really like the heart practices. When you do them, one of the monastics I know, a wonderful nun, Ayananda Bodhi, she said to us when we were having a baby, she was like, oh, devas, they love babies. They just, you can just feel them all around. That she came to our house to do a little blessing. She was like, you can just feel them. They're all around here. They love it. And metta practice is like that. You do a bunch of metta practice and like the little angelic beings kind of hover around. So, and you know, who knows about taking that literally? Like, go for it, take it literally. But I think that what it can also mean is that as we do it, we feel like there's a kind of goodness around. And that's this quality that we can cultivate. It may be quite dim in us, especially in darker times of our life. But we can lean into it. And the leaning into it is said to be just profoundly wholesome, so good for us to invoke these qualities of friendliness, kindness. The monks start doing this practice. The tree spirits are like, ooh, this is nice. And then the tree spirits decide to protect the monks so that no harm can come to them. And the grove becomes this place of great blessing and really a strong field for practice. One of the ways that metta is often talked about is in relation to this quality of it being impartial impersonal in a certain way. One of the classic styles of metta practice starts with us bringing to mind specific personal relationships, people that we really love, people that it's easy to send kindness to. The commentarial list says, start with your teachers because you love them in a pretty unconditional way, supposedly, and they're worthy of that love, supposedly, hopefully, and they're not complicated. It says don't start with like your partner or your kids or something like that because they're complicated. You start to love them, and then you think of all the things that annoy you about them. And so they say start with your teacher. It's really easy, and then go on to other beings. The early texts actually say start with yourself because they assume that loving yourself is obvious and easy. Ha. Those silly, innocent, ancient people before their egos got all muddled. Or I don't know, but that's the instruction. Start with yourself because it's easy and then generate the feeling of love and kindness and then radiate it to others. But of course, for a lot of us, myself is absolutely not the easiest person to radiate unconditional love toward. So in practice, we say, start with whoever's easy. Start with your dog. Start with, the previous president. You know, whoever you like. And but then the trajectory, the vector of the practice is to expand the web. So you start with people you like, and then you move on, you include yourself, and then you include the complicated people in your life, and then you include neutral people that you don't really know, but you kind of just saw them walk by on the street, and you're like, yeah, them too. May you be safe and happy and at ease. And then once you're really just feeling like you're just wishing well to all sorts of people, then you bring in your difficult people. And I first started doing this practice. I did my first intensive version of this practice, which is to say that you do this all day, every day, from waking to sleeping. I did it for 40 days the first time I did it intensively. Well, metta retreat. I was using phrases, which is one of the forms of doing this practice, where you say, you think of these different beings, and you just say, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be strong and at ease. May you live in well-being, the blessing of well-being. So I did this all day, every day for 40 days. On day 32 or so, I phoned my teacher, who I was having kind of weekly check-ins with. And he said, how's it going? I did this practice at a little adobe cabin out behind a friend's house in a tiny town in New Mexico. The town itself had like 50 people in it. And we were outside of that town, and I was behind their house. Really alone out there. It was super nice. And every afternoon I would sit on the porch of the house, and I would watch. There was this huge cottonwood tree in front of the cabin. And I would just kind of watch the birds come and go, and I would just do my phrases, whoever I happened to be thinking about. You move out through your difficult people to various classes of all beings. And essentially what you're doing is it's a concentration practice where you bring these different kind of objects, different beings or different classes of beings into focus, and you keep these phrases going. And you try to keep going both the phrases and the image and the feeling. And so it turns out that it's a fairly complex thing to do, which is partly why it helps you concentrate. And sometimes I would just drop all of that and just be in the feeling. And really, kind of, what an incredible way to spend a month and a half. Like, I'm just walking around the wilds of backwoods New Mexico through these little kind of farm areas in this valley. And some, you know, after a little while, it's just kind of just automatic. I'm just sort of like, oh, may you just be so safe and at ease. And just like all day, every day, until it's just like everything. May everything be okay. May everything be okay. On day 32, I called my teacher. He says, how's it going out there? I say, you know, it's beautiful. I love it. And, you know, just yesterday and today, I'm starting to feel like almost like a shadow is kind of passing over me, and it's like it feels like I'm wishing well, but there's just so much suffering in the world. Like, I can't wish enough well. And he said, well, I wasn't sure if I was going to tell you what just happened. And it turned out that the day I was talking to him was September 12th, 2001. And he was like, well, this just happened. Don't leave your retreat, because it's no fun out here. But you should know that there's a lot of suffering right now. And so I was like, okay. So he hung up the phone, and then there I was, just like sitting on the porch of this adobe cabin, looking at this cottonwood tree. And my phrases were still going, because they're now like embedded, just like, may all beings be at peace, be safe. It was lovely to not see the images, and to not hear any voices, and not hear any news, but just to be told by this fairly gentle old man that this had happened. And then to just go back to my retreat and know that I had another whole week of just being there. And just like walking through this, like, the most quiet valley maybe I'd ever been in. And just being like, okay, this is what's happening now. And I didn't even really know that, like, oh, this is... Because, you know, like, big tragedies happen. It didn't occur to me that, like, this was going to, for at least some period of time, be like the big tragedy that like marked this sort of turn in our culture. But there's actually no other place I could think that I would rather have been than just like week after week of just wishing well. A week later, my friends came to get me, and we did a nice little ritual to finish up, and I did a bunch of chants and prayers, and we were going to head off, and I was going to go with them to a straw bale building workshop in the Colorado mountains and do some stuff with mud. And that sounded great after where I'd been. And we had our first sort of conversation after that, and they were like, we kind of want to ask you, like, to tell us about it, but honestly, like, we're a mess, you know? So, and I was like, yeah, I kind of heard. And they were like, do you want to know anything? And I'm like, not really, not yet, not yet. So metta, this quality of friendliness, kindness, is known for being impersonal. And part of what that shines a light on for us is that the thing that we think of as love, so often it is, essentially has some of this quality of deep, just heart wish for well-being, but very often accompanied by, you know, a serving or a layer or a sheath, a veil of attachment, right? Or different kinds of desire, right? I wish you well and I want to take you to bed is a kind of love, right? And it has multiple qualities in it, right? I wish you well, and if anything ever happened to you, that would just be like the end of my world. Right? That's a kind of love. But it's not exactly metta. Right? It's metta plus something else, different kinds of attachment. Not all of which are bad, right? We're not renunciate monastics. Like, romantic love is beautiful, and family love is beautiful, and the connection of intimate friendship is beautiful. And these things are understood to be profound supports in practice and life, not to be given up until you are ready to give them up. So to feel into, though, this vast impersonal love, I think can, for many of us, be a beautiful both healing and a support in relation to other kinds of love, because our personal or relationship kinds of loves can so often get so complex. The love we have for many different kinds of beings that are specific is all colored by that specificity. This is my partner, these are my children, this is my family, this is my community, my friends, my affinity group, my race, culture, class, my people, my tribe. And all of those have different flavors of love to them. And all of those flavors of love are colored by a certain kind of exclusivity. Right? I have this partner and no other. Or in the Bay Area, I have these partners and no other, you know. Or this is my family and that's not. This is my race and that's not. This is my culture, my queer tribe, my whoever my people are, and the others are not. This is my nation, and others are not. And so all of the forms of love that are colored by exclusion have this focus to them that focuses on the particular qualities of the loved being, of the love object. And one of the things that can be challenging about metta initially is that sometimes we don't know any other kind of love other than the kind of love that is specific to its object, right? I love these kinds of people or this people. And metta very specifically and very quickly in the practice of it, often in a single session you'll get to this, it says, drop that, stay with the feeling of loving, but connect with the kind of love that could that could touch or reach into every kind of being, including the ones you dislike, including the ones that you fear, including the ones that you don't know at all, including entire realms that you don't even know exist. Love them anyway. And so this is what's unique about metta, I think, as a feeling. And it's and it can make it both a beautiful refuge for us emotionally and a subtle quality of the heart that can take some time to really develop, to really find, like, oh, I'm actually pretty good at feeling like I'm loving everybody. One of the great ways to be impartial is to not even really think about the distinctions between people and just be like, I just love them all, right? That's kind of easy, actually. And then they show up in their particulars, and you're like, well, I don't really love those guys, I don't know, you know. Part of the beauty of the traditional metta sequence is that it forces you to confront all these people, the difficult people category. For a while during that era, I used George W. as my difficult person, because I'm of that particular political persuasion. At a different point in my practice, I used my mother. May she rest in peace. I stopped using her as my difficult person once I realized that she was no longer difficult for me. I wish that had happened while she was still alive, but it didn't. It's not entirely true. It shifted a bit, slowly, before she passed. But metta as a purification practice actually tells us in a certain way to almost like oscillate between the specific and the universal love. It says, you know, build up the feeling by loving on your teacher, on your good friend, on people that you really adore easily. And then it's almost like you do this fake out. You know, you get like really, oh my God, I just love you guys so much. You're so, what, such wonderful people, such wonderful people. You just go, whoosh, and you put the difficult people there, and you're like, I love. Oh. Right? And as it gets some momentum, it's like, oh, you're people. Haha. Right. You have an upset stomach, and you lost someone you love, and you wish the world was better. Even though the way you want to get there, I don't believe in, don't worry about it. Right? You wish things were better. Of course you do. You don't like pain. Of course you don't. And it's like, right. You take people from this larger perspective, and then it becomes easy. And so cultivating metta, it's almost like we zoom the lens in and out, into the specific, the easy people, out to the universal, back in to the neutral people, and develop that, the skill of loving them too, and then out to different classes of beings, right? Can I love the bugs the same as I love the dolphins? Can I love you get the picture. Part of where this leads then is not just the heart practice of spreading love in all the directions, but it unfolds into a wisdom practice. Because as we see all beings as worthy of love, whether we agree with them or not, whether we know of them or not, we start to dissolve the rigidity in other parts of our being that holds the boundary of self and other. This is good, that's not good. These people are right, those people are wrong. And bit by bit, we start to fear the other less. And the less we fear the other, the less we start to fear loss and death itself. And in the end, I think partly where this is pointing is that the quality of liberation that rests in equanimity with all things as they change, and the quality of loving all things no matter what they are turns out to be pretty similar. The insight is that they are very, very close qualities. The well-known quote that points to this, I'll end with, it's from the teacher Sri Nisargadatta, who taught my teacher, so a grandfather teacher to me, a very beloved teacher in the Advaita tradition, said, supposedly, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between these two, my life flows. Wisdom shows me I'm nothing. Love shows me I'm everything. Every time we say this closing blessing, it's a hint toward this quality of vast, impartial wisdom love. May all beings be well. May all beings be at ease. Thanks for listening. Pleasure. And any thoughts and feelings from you? Questions, anything about your practice?
I'm just kind of curious, as I'm still conceptualizing this.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on metta practice and being able to differentiate that between spiritual bypassing. Specifically when it comes to, and I'm thinking from like social justice context and this aspect of love to all beings.
Yep.
And I'm just trying to notice myself.
So a question about the practice of loving all beings, the metta practice, and then spiritual bypass, especially in a social justice context, for sure. In a sense, I hear, like, we want to be discerning in our own cultivation. You know, am I doing what's wholesome? Am I missing something, is the spiritual bypass question. I think any of the practices that point toward the universal have the possibility of being used, co-opted by spiritual bypass. Spiritual bypass is, you know, using a spiritual doctrine or practice or form not as a way to see more clearly, but as a way to avoid some aspect of life that we prefer not to see. So, like, using loving all beings as a way to not deal with the specific differences between beings that actually bring up a lot of different feelings in us. I think this is partly why we don't just go to the universal level. It's not just like all beings, all beings, all beings. But that we always come back to beings I like, beings I don't like, neutral beings, difficult beings, and actually go through those categories and be willing to again, what feels like kind of zoom in and out again. I think that as sincere practitioners, there's a quality that we can tune into when we're doing whatever kind of, any kind of practice, where it's like I'm doing a certain kind of practice and it's accessing a certain body of content in me. And inevitably when I'm doing any kind of practice, it touches some strata of my being and not others. You know, if I'm doing breath concentration, I'm not going to be processing my childhood at the same time, necessarily, right? Especially if I'm quite concentrated, I'm doing less and less other things the more concentrated I am. So any kind of practice is like this, right? I can be doing my yoga asana practice, and I can be, you know, avoiding my fear of stillness. I can be doing my sitting meditation practice and avoiding my fear of relationship practice. I can be doing relationship practice and avoiding my fear of myself. Like a million different ways we can use practice in an unwholesome way. So what we want to have always is a little discernment that's awake in us that just says, you know, not so much is this practice not accessing some other layer, because of course it is, right? Every practice accesses some layer. But is there a layer that's calling out to be known that I am actively, even if unconsciously, ignoring or bypassing by doing this thing? In other words, is there embedded somehow in my choice of doing this practice, even if I'm not, even if this is a little unconscious, is there some kind of active denial? And if so, then I want to know that that quality is present, because I just want to be, I want to know every quality that's present. And if it's present, then I want to feel it, and if I feel it, then the door to that thing opens. So, I want us to trust ourselves that we're sincere in our practice and not always doubt ourselves and think like, oh no, I'm doing bypass because I'm doing this thing or that thing. But to trust that, that there is enough discernment and sincere wish to grow in us that that'll reveal itself. And as the Zen people say, you know, delusion is boundless. Yeah, Anna.
So to kind of take a thread of that, my understanding is that the metta practice is concentration practice, and I'm not magically sending love to Elise, but I'm building up my...
You could ask her if she feels it. I'm sure. I know she does.
I hope you feel it.
I mean, but, who knows?
But that
pressure.
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. No pressure.
Tell me later. But yeah. But that I'm building up my own muscle. That
yes.
I'm developing. I guess the goal is an equanimity of compassion.
Right.
An equanimity of metta.
We're not holding as central to the metta practice that we are doing a magical sending of good vibes to others.
Right.
That said. You know, when people are really nice, you feel it.
Word.
Word?
Yeah.
And, and you know, hella studies about prayer.
Yeah.
Where they give a group of old church ladies in Oklahoma a bunch of names of people that they've never met, have them pray for them.
Those people do better in surgery.
They do better.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, no.
Right?
I'm down with that.
You're down.
But my question is more about, if the goal, which is not my favorite word choice, but if I'm moving towards equanimity mm-hmm. in loving kindness, mm-hmm. is the goal that when I'm taking the person who's a difficult person for me becomes an easy person for me? Or does that person remain a difficult person to me, but my feeling towards them becomes analogous to my feeling towards Elise or someone I care for.
She felt it that time.
She felt it. So nice. Well, it's a really good question. Like, if we figure out how to feel kindness towards someone, do they stay difficult? Like, what's the definition of difficult in the difficult person? Oh. Right? We might say, they do things I don't agree with. But, you know, what happens if I transform them in my mind into a suffering being who, you know, forgive them, Father, they know not what they do. Like, there's a kindness that says, yep, these people are acting according to their karma. It's, you know, it looks pretty deluded. It's causing a lot of harm. But I know that they are, you know, doing the best they can in very trying circumstances. Do they stay difficult? So I think that, yeah, when we do difficult person practice with people, they they cease being our difficult person. They might very well, almost certainly, will continue to be themselves and do their own thing. So, you know, my sending metta to George Bush, I don't know that it did anything for him, although, you know, his painting improved.
Oh.
You know. But we didn't have a control group of ex-presidents who took up painting and disappeared from the public view and didn't improve in their painting. So who knows what was the cause of that. But yeah, it's not the point, right? But it is. It does seem to be true that people don't stay in your difficult category for very long.
I got a few people in my difficult category for a while.
Of course you do. Of course you do. I do too. Yeah. And we're not trying to get them out of it. That's not the point.
Okay.
The point actually is just to love them. Period. Like, oh, you difficult being, may you be safe. Right? Like, I wouldn't wish further harm upon you, even though you do all this shitty shit. And then you just start again. Oh, you difficult person, you know, may you be healthy. Because being sick sucks. Even though you do all this shitty shit, etc.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. You all
right? I'm curious about, like, I was sort of like, well, I don't know, a couple things were going on from when you were talking. And one of them is that I kind of, love becomes this elusive thing where it's kind of like just blah, 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 and it, like, doesn't actually, like, mean anything. And then
yeah.
The other thing that was happening for me was that, like,
that's like the adults in Charlie Brown, right?
Yeah.
Like,
wah,
wah, wah. And then well, the sensation of love, and so when we were like talking about it, feels pretty easy for me to access, but it feels like it has a bias of like good or bad or right or wrong or pleasure or pain. It's it's like the mother comforting the child in a rocking chair on the back porch, humming.
Yep.
You know, on a peaceful summer afternoon is love, right? And then when you started talking about, like, wisdom, when we started talking about, like, this meta, it becomes sort of, like, blurry to the point where it felt to me as if it's neutral or, like, nature is indifferent almost. And then at the end you said something about, like, wisdom being kind of indifferent or neutral and love being a definite discernment. But the way you were describing it almost felt like there's this external force in the world that isn't me and isn't you, that is love, that is a discernment one way or the other.
Yeah.
Because it's easier for me to just, like, know that nature is neutral wisdom or something, that wisdom of just kind of like neutrality.
Yes.
It's hard for me to think that there's some force out there that's just either here or there, like a love thing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Am I making any sense to anybody? Or am I just back to Charlie Brown?
You're not Charlie Brown.
Anyway.
He was so depressed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you a little bit of what I hear in it, and it may or may not be exactly accurate to the question, but there is this piece about, I think it's true for me, and I think a lot of folks, that personal or specific love, love that distinguishes between, like, this is love and that is not, is much easier to feel. Like, I have access to that.
Mm-hmm.
Where the universal, it does very easily become, especially when I'm not particularly concentrated, it becomes this kind of, like, easy thing to say.
Yeah.
You know? And part of why I think in the tradition of working through these categories, there's this thing about starting with easy, very personal beings, is that there's a recognition that the feeling doesn't immediately translate. So it would almost be like, meditate on the mother with the baby in the rocker on the porch in the summer evening, like the perfect, like pure distilled tincture of love. And taste it like with your whole being, and do that substantially. So like when I was on retreat for this 40 days, they say work with the first category. So work with yourself or your or the easy personal love for 2 weeks. That's all day, every day, not moving on to the neutral people, the difficult people or anything. That's a lot of wishing yourself well. And the idea is just like keep doing that until you actually get a feeling. And only once you get a feeling, then you expand it a little bit. Mm-hmm. So like you hang out with the mama on the porch, on the rocker, the pure love feeling. And then you, you know, imagine it radiating out to her whole extended family and all of the wolves and groundhogs mm-hmm. on her land. And just that. And like, see if you could hold that intensity or fullness of feeling and expand the circle a little bit. And then the practice of it is just to kind of like expand the circle a little bit at a time until you can actually maintain that juicy feeling in a more broad context. And for folks who have been wounded around love, some folks will never expand the circle very far. Not because they can't. They might choose not to. I had a student who was like, I've been doing metta for myself for 10 years, and I'm just not ready to move on. Right? I came into my teacher really, really doubtful and depressed and unhappy about myself at one point. And he said, sometimes I tell people like you to do metta for yourself for a year. Every single day, don't do breath practice, don't do nothing else. Wish yourself well every day for a year. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. but it can be that delicate a process to expand it that far. So those things are different. I'll talk more this month about the wisdom piece that is this interesting place where like love that like sees a particular thing and loves it, whatever that quality is, you know, wants it to be so cared for, becomes this kind of wise witness. Like, if I really love a being, and then I stick with them over time, I'm going to see them fluctuate, and they're going to be joyful, and they're going to be miserable, and if my love is constant, it has to kind of expand to meet all those different states and still love them. Maybe they start to hate me at some point or things get rough and I keep loving them somehow or find the capacity to keep loving them. And if that keeps going, at a certain point, what the love is isn't this kind of hot, like warm, always nurturing thing. It's more like, I see you exactly as you are. Right? Love becomes kind of mature witness at a certain point and doesn't have that kind of like, oh, you thing to it. So I think I hear some of what this when you ask about the wisdom piece. I think this is some of where the wisdom piece points us toward, that they're kind of on a spectrum, and that when love gets super big and universal, it has some of this quality. It turns it more and more into equanimity yeah. of just like, everything you are, I love it. You know, right?
Yeah,
all
the... It doesn't mean that it's like all okay or good.
Yeah.
Like pleasure or whatever, or some yummy sensation of love.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like a big peace or something, neutrality, nature, like wisdom.
Right? All of that. Absolutely. It's not always pleasant. How many folks in here have been in an intimate relationship for more than a decade or so? It's not very common anymore, right? Even you know, a few years, and you've not been entirely pleased with your person all the time. And so, what is that quality that keeps you together, where you're just like, you know, yep, it's you. Oh, look, it's you again. You know,
still you.
Still you. That part that I wished was different, I still wish it was different. You know, and you know, and the love is there. And even like, I don't like you today, but the love is there. And what if, and this is just like, what if that exact quality of like, I don't like you today, but the love is there. What if that could get so big that it could like encompass the entirety of the world with its nasty dictators and just everything and be like, you know, I don't like North Korea this today, all of this century, since partition. But it's okay, but the love is there, right? I don't like my government right now, but the love is there. Like, and the love is there, it doesn't even mean that, what does it even mean in relation to my nation? I don't know, right? It means that I haven't given up yet. Maybe that's what it means, you know.
There's no such thing as giving up at a certain point, if you
right.
get that meta, because
right.
it's like...
Where are you going to go?
Giving up is okay, and love
yeah.
too, like even like everything
yeah.
falling apart and all of humanity burning is like fine.
Absolutely.
You know, like it's all okay.
It's all okay, that's the wisdom piece, right, that
yeah.
gets that big. How many folks have a relationship that they are no longer in, but the love is still there?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's that part of metta also, right? Like, oh, even the breaking apart wasn't the end of love. You know, it was the right thing to do, perhaps, right? In many cases it was, but it wasn't the end of love. I think all of those things and what you're pointing to is like, oh, the heart can actually get that big, which is kind of amazing. And so, something like that. Yeah, please.
Are we running?
We are, but please.
I struggle with maybe something similar, which is the part of the blessing about all beings everywhere being safe and well.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's harder for me than accessing a sense of metta.
Yeah.
Because... And we probably have different worldviews in this circle, but my worldview is such that I think the universe is fairly indifferent, and that its
mm-hmm.
common denominator, to quote
mm-hmm.
Werner Herzog, is chaos, pain, and death.
Ah, right.
And it's very Buddhist, but I think about that every time I come to that blessing, and it makes it feel superficial to me, because I think there's something fundamental to the universe that makes it impossible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I can't.
Well, this is a very Buddhist.
Yeah.
Understanding, actually, right? Old age, sickness, and death
right.
are inevitable. It's very
yeah.
Werner. So so then...
Buddhist, Werner Herzog.
Yeah, it's totally. I can hear his voice, you know. But this becomes a really interesting question, because those two things are actually... We don't even have to go outside the tradition, you know. The Buddha says, the truth of suffering, period. And then he says... You know, radiate kindness to all beings. Radiate the wish for safety and well-being to all beings. And how do you hold those two things together? Because we know that beings aren't safe, right? Beings are subject to old age, sickness, death, loss, etc. And so, there's a mysterious quality that we can embody that... In some amazing way, I think this is what part of what metta points toward, is that the wish for a being to be safe is completely natural, because we want ourselves to be safe. We know what that's like. Like, I wish that you don't come to harm. I know that you'll die, but I just send the wish that you not come to harm. And it's almost like the inevitability of pain and loss makes the wish more poignant, even. And I can still wish it. This is very strange. I know that I can't protect you from loss and grief and death, ultimately, but I wish for you to not suffer. Right? I wish for you the feeling of safety and ease and joy. And so... I don't have a great logical answer, like a philosophical answer, for why the one should not be superficial in relation to the other. But but my hunch is that in a mysterious way, they balance each other. That actually it's not that one is more deep and the other one is superficial, like you will die, but I'm going to sort of give you this surface wish that you are safe, even though of course you aren't. It's almost like, what if we flipped them, and if we take on the doctrine of rebirth, for instance, we could flip them, we could be like, oh, you've died a million times already. What I'm wishing for you actually is for the profound safety of liberation, which is freedom from birth and death entirely. And maybe that's quite deep, and that death itself is superficial, that actually loss and grief are relatively superficial compared to full liberation. That would also be a very Buddhist sentiment. So I think that they could go either way, and if that's true, then I want to just hold them side by side and be like, the piece about inevitable loss, this is the wisdom piece also. This is like, yep, entropy. Right? Systems orient toward dissolving. What then happens when I, in the middle of that, knowing that I'm not separate from that dissolving and loss at all, cultivate the heart that just blesses everyone as they dissolve? And that becomes a really interesting state to hold. And I think as someone who wants to serve beings, it's an interesting state to hold. Because we have to somehow hope that our actions are going to serve folks, even though we know that ultimately they will grow old, get sick and die, lose all they love, etc. So I'm glad you ask it, because for me now, as I think about it, I'm like, well, that's really mysterious. You know, that's like on the sort of great mystery level, that both of these things are could be true. So, something like that. That's a non-answer.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for saying it. All right, so we'll say goodnight for now. It's a pleasure to see you. Your generosity in supporting the group is vital and always gratefully received. Your donations are split in half between the studio and myself. And your signing in, also telling the studio that you were here, helps them to value us as well. So thank you for your generosity and for how your generosity supports others of many different levels of means to be here. See you next week, and we'll talk about compassion and suffering. Yes. You people, you're like, suffering, compassion, woohoo.